Chapter 12. We can see that all elements of the socialist ideal, the abolition of private property, family, hierarchies, the hostility toward religion, could be regarded as manifestations of one basic principle, the suppression of individuality, the destruction of individuality, or at least its suppression to a point where it would cease to be a social force. Igor Shafarovich. The ultimate objective of the new policy is not to learn more secrets about the adversary, and not even to teach the masses in the West in the spirit of Marxism-Leninist ideology, but to slowly replace the free market capitalist society with its individual freedoms and economic and socio-political spheres of life with a carbon copy of the most progressive system, and eventually merge into one world-wide system ruled by a benevolent bureaucracy which they call socialism or communism as the final and supreme stage of this progress. To effect this change, it is much easier to change the perceptions of reality, attitudes, patterns of behavior, and to create widespread demands and expectations, leading ultimately to the acceptance of totalitarianism. Thomas Schumann, a.k.a. Yuri Besmenov. There was a moment of silence while this, as it turned out, all too exact prophecy sank in. And then the previous conversations resumed. Hippolyte 10, as related by Malcolm Muggeridge. The funny thing about this book, if there is a funny thing about this book, is that in setting out to explore the breaches in those bastions of tradition assumed to be manned by conservatives, that became apparent as the Western world struggled with an expanding, flexing, and combusting Islam. I expected to focus mainly on the disconnect between facts and conclusions about Islam, not communism. Communism, it seemed, was an erstwhile threat, supposedly vanquished decades ago. Then the past 11 chapters took shape. Meanwhile, I continued to write my syndicated weekly newspaper column, amassing a body of work supplemented by blog essays which, since 9/11, amounts to an almost uninterrupted chronicle of Islam's fearsome impact on the Western mind, the place where denial and delusion insert themselves between fact and conclusion. I have tracked this phenomenon through the culture, where Sharia norms, Islamic law, are increasingly deferred to avert violence. In politics, where liberty shrinks to maintain an increasingly Sharia-compliant order to avert violence. And in the military, where Sharia-based demands for respect, submission, drive military strategy, also to avert violence. It wasn't very long after 9/11 that it became apparent that, like true Dhimmi, we were submitting to Islam's cult of superiority as a byproduct of our own cultural devolution into childishness by choice. This idea was the impetus behind my first book, The Death of the Grown-Up. Of course, first, I had to learn what Dhimmi were. The Arabic term refers to Christians and Jews who, conquered by Islam, live suppressed and diminished lives according to the strictures of Sharia. These laws enforce the Quranic command that Dhimmi feel themselves subdued from Surah 9:29. The miserable history of the Dhimmi is the single most relevant aspect of Islam to anyone who is not Muslim. Why? Even in those parts of the world culturally and religiously separate from Islam, the paradigm of the Dhimmi not only defines Islamic attitudes toward infidels, it also prefigures the infidel response to Islam. This relationship turns on what may be the oldest mind game in history. As populations come under the pressure of Islamic immigration, a phenomenon of conquest through immigration called al-hijra, as the Netherlands Geert Wilders puts it. They also come under the pressure of Islamic grievances and demands, always accompanied by the threat or reality of violence. This constitutes the period of pre-violent jihad, broken by outbursts of violence, in which passive-aggressive Islam is able to trigger in non-Islamic populations the apology reflex, the accommodation reflex, the appeasement reflex, and finally the rollover and play dead reflex, all of which permit Islam's advance. Full-blown violent jihad ensues as necessary. What historian Bat-Yor calls dimitude deepens. As when, for example, a university in Britain, through whose unsurpassed literary tradition run veritable rivers of mead, ales, and whiskey, considers closing campus bars due to the minority Muslim view of alcohol as immoral. This dimitude, Bat-Yor discovered, is a cultural, mental, and even spiritual condition, traceable to all nations and peoples contending with Islam through history, recognizable by markers of supplication, self-abnegation, and, most tellingly, fear, and, most relevantly, silence. Again, such dimitude can and does mark societies that are ostensibly non-Islamic. Or is that pre-Islamic? I was lucky to learn about dimitude early in this latest cycle of global jihad. My education began when, along with the Quran, I picked up a copy of Ibn Warraq's Essential, Why I Am Not a Muslim, written in 1995, at a local bookstore outside New York City on September 12, 2001. A few months later, at the beginning of 2002, in response to a column I had written puzzling through a C-SPAN panel discussion of Islam, which was part double talk from Islamic clerics and part fact-based logic from Christian ministers. Andrew G. Bostom, a medical professor at Brown University, wrote to ask me whether he could send me a collection of books by Bat-Yor. He was finding that her historical research into jihad and dimitude was filling in the blanks on our contemporary quandaries. Well, why not? Yes, of course, I replied, and he kindly sent several books my way. The Dhimmi, The Decline of Eastern Christianity, and Islam and Dimitude, all keys from an exotic, distant past to understanding our postmodern plight. Bostom had come across Bat-Yor's body of research shortly after 9/11, a time when some among us beginning to realize that what we were all hearing 24/7 on cable, on NPR, in the New York Times, from all the experts, John Esposito, Karen Armstrong, Juan Cole, ex-ambassadors to Saudi Arabia, and the like, was out of sync with what we were watching before our eyes. In other words, the narrative, Islam is peace, was not supported by the evidence. Islam is violence. Islam is slavery. Islam is forced conversion. Islam is child rape. Islam is pillage. Islam is religious cleansing. Islam is death for apostasy. Islam is censorship. Islam is conquest. Such fact-based observations trigger charges of that sin of sins, Islamophobia, racism being its domestic twin. But does name-calling, Islamophobe, make these serious crimes and their real victims go away? In our world, yes. Over nearly a century of big lies, we have learned to discount fact and disable logic. As in a frustration dream, the crimes, the victims, their suffering, vanishes in the magic word, Islamophobia. What remains? Slanderous allegations of prejudice, permanent brands of bias, trigger the revulsion reflex in the postmodern brain, long programmed to be vigilant against racism, lynch mobs, the KKK, and the like. Extant or not, functional or not, these usually faux stimuli create outrage Islam exploits as Islamophobia. Have you left no sense of decency? This pattern is very old. In pre-McCarthy times, the all-powerful word that stopped the logic process cold was red-baiter. In 1938, J.B. Matthews, a truth-teller who would later work for Senator McCarthy and would himself be publicly neutralized, slimed, for this same crime, described red-baiting as the best trick ever invented, short of a firing squad, for making short work of anybody who dares to object to communist theories and practices. If he is not effectively silenced, he is at least thoroughly discredited among the vast flock of citizens who enjoy thinking of themselves as liberals. Substitute Islamophobia for red-baiting, and the statement describes the fail-safe technique that has kept the facts of jihad, the consequences of jihad, under official wraps since 9/11, silencing and discrediting anybody who dares to object to Islamic theories and practices. Instead, we were supposed to ponder, why do they hate us? This was the question public figures, the commentariat, the academy, the birds in the trees called out to one another in those weeks and months as the battleground carnage in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania cooled and was sorted. This was no mystery that reading about the hate for the other, codified in the Quran, couldn't have readily solved. But experts bypassed the answer, many of them already deep into what Bertrand Russell might well have called the conspiracy of concealment, his 1920 phrase for the lies Western visitors to newly Bolshevik Russia considered necessary, he wrote, to make the nascent police state appear civilized in the eyes of the outside world. At the same time, Russell made the following memorable comparison between what was at that time exhausted Islam and high-riding Bolshevism. Bolshevism combines the characteristics of the French Revolution with those of the rise of Islam. Marx has taught that communism is fatally predestined to come about. This produces a state of mind not unlike that of the early successors of Muhammad. Among religions, Bolshevism is to be reckoned with Mohammedanism rather than with Christianity and Buddhism. Christianity and Buddhism are primarily personal religions with mystical doctrines and a love of contemplation. Mohammedanism and Bolshevism are practical, social, unspiritual, concerned to win the empire of this world. 80-90 years later, in a time of high-rising Islam and not exactly exhausted, but transformed communism, a soundbite like that would get a pundit zapped on Meet the Press or CNN for insubordinate Islamophobia, perhaps sending the Weekly Standard's Bill Kristol into ridicule mode over intimations of the coming Islamic empire known as the Caliphate. Meanwhile, just as pointing out communism's stated drive to control the world was once a prompt for charges of red-baiting, now pointing out Islam's stated drive to impose its totalitarian system of religion, law, and politics onto the world is a prompt for charges of Islamophobia. Islam, we are told, has nothing to do with anything bad. Back in 2001, we heard that the cause of the 9/11 attacks was colonialism, imperialism, neo-colonialism, the founding of the modern state of Israel, U.S. foreign policy, the same old Leninist grand narrative all over again, as the late Laurent Mirowick put it, which is a point worth tucking away in the comparative totalitarianism file. Every one of these supposed explanations, of course, date to more than a millennium after Muhammad became the jihad model, as Muslim Brotherhood spiritual advisor Yusuf al-Qaradawi describes Islam's prophet for forcing Islam onto the world through holy war. Islam means peace, said the President of the United States. No, in fact, Islam means submission. There's a huge difference. And it explains why Islam celebrated the fall of the Twin Towers in Gaza, Kabul, and Queens. Dimitude, already evident in our society, goes a long way to explain why we didn't dare show that we had noticed. What we were witnessing were the marshaling forces of the latest, greatest big lie. This was one big lie I didn't have to stumble across in an out-of-print book or extract from 1950s congressional testimony. I was watching it evolve, close up and in real time, as a matter of professional as well as national interest. I saw how, pace communist penetration of yore, this big lie was actively pressed on us by cadres of agents of Islam and their own armies of useful fools. Members of the Muslim Brotherhood fobbed off as advocates of a pluralistic and American Islam, the ex-Saudi Ambassadors Club, the Iran Lobby, Saudi Princelings, the International Islamic Bloc, now known as the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the OIC, the Bush administration, the Obama administration, practically anyone on a TV soundstage, all reasonable people, they all peddled the same big lie. Islam is a religion of peace. I saved an email from a reader who recalled, I'll never forget right after 9/11 how the very walls seemed to echo, religion of peace, religion of peace, tiny band of extremists, as if the media, especially them, were pre-programmed to say those words for a long time before any such attack. For what it's worth, I was still living on Long Island at that time, knew almost nothing about Islam or jihad. Ah, antediluvian idol, shattered by echoes of religion of peace. It's not that Islamic apologetics are something new under the sun. They are a familiar aspect of historical dimitude, and had returned to the Western Academy and to politics certainly by the 1960s and 70s. As a tool of political control, however, post-9/11 Islamic apologetics achieved a cosmic force, drawing super strength from the wellspring of non-specific Western guilt and achieving maximum spread from the Big Bang effect of mass media. As we have seen, once a big lie is put over, it's nearly impossible to call it back by reintroducing the truth. Robert Conquest, Terror Famine, Julius Epstein, Katyn, and Robert Dallin, the Gulag, pre-Solzhenitsyn, were truth-tellers who ultimately, after great exertions, were more or less successful, presenting facts that reached a position accessible to consensus. Claire Sterling, too, with her 1981 book, The Terror Network, was able to go far in pinning blame for international terrorism at Moscow's door, mainly, if not exclusively, due to the priorities of the incoming Reagan administration, an anomaly in American history for breaking the pattern of Soviet appeasement in certain significant ways. Note the fact that as Moscow trained and supported international terrorist groups, including an array of Arab terror groups, read Islamic Jihad groups, we see the communist strategic design incorporating, if not also reigniting, that of rising Islam. Is that something that should worry us today? Let's say it's something to consider. By 1998, according to the late Alexander Litvinenko, assassinated in 2006 in London by what was in effect a miniature nuclear device deployed by Russia, Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri, an old SFB agent, according to Litvinenko, was transferred to Afghanistan following Russian training at an FSB station in Dagestan. Once in Afghanistan, Litvinenko claimed, following the recommendation of his Lubyanka chiefs, Zawahiri at once penetrated the milieu of bin Laden and soon became his assistant in Al-Qaeda. Am I digressing? Not really. Everything fits in a multidimensional fashion, no matter how tightly we close our eyes. 9 years after Sterling published her book, for example, Joseph D. Douglas Jr. produced a similarly trailbreaking and even more sensational work, Red Cocaine, The Drugging of America, which documents an even dirtier communist secret, the Soviet deployment of narcotics in the creation and maintenance of the Western drug epidemic against our future leaders, our own children, from soldiers in Vietnam to students at home. It was a weapon of uncanny genius, a weapon the West could and did use against itself. It could well be that the moral rot from the Sino-Soviet tsunami of mind-altering chemical poison and morality-altering corruption will prove to be the coup de grace against us, but we'll never know it. Ignorance is bliss? No, it's just ignorance. Laurent Mirowick was a senior scholar with the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. He described the big post-9/11 lie this way. All of this, he said, referring to the Islam is peace propaganda of Western and Muslim experts alike, represented an erasure of memory, a destruction of history, and pure scholarly fraud. Why? The history didn't conform to the narrative, he explained. The evidence undermined the ideology. Therefore, the history, the evidence couldn't, mustn't stand. It didn't fit to summon Andrew and Maturkin's phrase, the existing view. The year was 2006, and Murawick was speaking at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., in appraisal of the legacy of jihad, the 759-page annotated compendium that Andrew Bostom, the doctor who sent Batyor's works my way, ended up putting together himself to fight the big lie that had arisen post-9/11. This book remains unique, even as Bostom, an M.D., has published two more valuable books on Islam. It is a collection of writings spanning hundreds of years by a variety of Islamic jurists and commentators, other historical eyewitnesses, and a multinational selection of scholars best described for now as pre-PC. Together, their essays catalog the enduring Islamic institution of jihad to extend Islam's rule over the world. When I first read the manuscript, I was initially frustrated by the repetitiveness, jihad here, jihad there, jihad over and over again. And then, eureka, I got it. Jihad is repetitive. It doesn't stop. Murawick picked up on this point in his discussion of the book, pointing to the 10 continuous centuries of jihad in Europe, from the middle of the 7th century until the Battle of Vienna in 1683, that do not exist in our historical consciousness and are documented in Bostom's book. This is one extremely big lie conquest did not consider, although it may be the most enduring of all. It did not, however, much affect the West until a resurgent Islam returned to our sphere, our thoughts, our economics, in the second half of the 20th century. Laurent continued, calling the book, above all, an indictment of academia. Big Liars Emeritus. You need to open Andy's book to reopen the reality of that history, which has been erased from memory. It is a shame and a scandal that no scholar from our richly endowed universities has done what an outsider who decided to work seriously did in a few years. I cite this one lecture I happen to have attended, about this one book I happen to have read, by an author I happen to know, for a reason. This sweeping indictment of the experts, this clear accusation of the trahison de Clercq, was stunning, partly because it was so rare, almost unique. The trahison de Clercq should be obvious to anyone familiar with the history, but so few of us are familiar with the history, while even fewer of us feel free enough to speak familiarly about the history. In a fact-devoid, logic-disabled world, the history, the evidence, just sits there, unclaimed for the most part, just another competing narrative. This evidence is overshadowed, outspent, outclassed by the party line, mouthed by every politician and pundit, and zapping every satellite dish. Islam is a religion of peace. Did the facts about Islam as retrieved, for example, in this one lone book about jihad make a dent? Did the facts, as retrieved in a nearly continuous stream of counter-jihad research and books and papers and lectures by a sturdy band of writers, bloggers, researchers, security, law enforcement, and military professionals, cause the Islamic big lie of our age to crack and shrink, even a little? Not so much, not really. In a way, it was, we will meet the Americans and we will tell them, all over again. No one but no one wanted the evidence that contradicted the narrative, the ideology. No one but no one seemed to be able to process the information from fact to conclusion. Why? This became my personal interest, especially as I became perplexed that simply showing, presenting evidence contra Islam is a religion of peace, wasn't telling. That is, the presentation of blunt facts wasn't triggering even basic conclusions. I continued to ponder parallels between the stunted existence of Dimitude and what I decided to call the death of the grown-up, explaining the disconnect as a matter of the self-indulgent immaturity that defines our culture, which became the 2007 book. In recent years, I have found there is a deeper level to examine. Something else is going on underneath the surface, where we see manifestations of the death of the grown-up, that maintains the crucial disconnect between the historical, canonical, cultural, legal, financial fact of jihad, holy war to extend the totalitarian rule of Islam, which is a fundamental imperative of Islam across time and space and all schools and sects, and which creates Dhimmitude and the slogan that was instantly internalized, chanted, and needle-pointed across the West, heart and mind, brain and yap. Islam is a religion of peace. Into this disconnect, rather into this endless chasm of 1984-style absurdity, all of America, right, left, and center, leaped like lemmings on September 12, 2001. They haven't hit bottom yet. Taking a page from Hanson Baldwin, I hereby declare that just as believing our own, and, we know now, their own, propaganda that communism had changed its stripes was World War II's greatest mistake, believing our own propaganda that Islam had changed its stripes is this war's greatest mistake. Or is it believing their own propaganda too? When, to take some random examples, Imam Muhammad Majid, head of the Islamic Society of North America, one of numerous fronts for the Muslim Brotherhood that the Justice Department has named as unindicted co-conspirators in the Holy Land Foundation trial, the largest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history, for their roles in funding Hamas, is asked by the Department of Homeland Security to help combat homegrown extremism. The question isn't merely rhetorical. The fox not only guards the henhouse, he sets security protocols. When the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, a homegrown radical group given, just for starters, that its co-founder, Niyad Awad, was identified by the FBI as a member of Hamas, a wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that it was also named an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land Foundation trial, can successfully pressure the CIA to cancel a three-day conference in 2011 on homegrown radicalization, can successfully pressure West Point to cancel the appearance of an American hero, General William G. Jerry Boykin, co-founder of Delta Force, from appearing at a West Point prayer breakfast in 2012. The question isn't merely rhetorical, either. The fox is preventing essential threat information, to extend the metaphor a little too far, from getting to the farmer. Worse, he is setting limits on speech and also determining who is fit to speak. To open up the horizon of crazy, similarly, when Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, nephew of the dictator of Saudi Arabia, for many years owns the second largest stake in Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, which in turn owned Fox News and the Wall Street Journal, among other media properties, not to mention substantial stakes in flagship American universities, Harvard and Georgetown, which now teach Sharia, the question isn't merely rhetorical either. Once upon a short time ago, Al-Walid was notorious for having donated $10 million to the Twin Towers Fund, only to have Rudy Giuliani return the check after the prince released an incendiary statement linking the 9/11 attacks to American support for Israel. While, as Al-Walid's statement read, our Palestinian brethren continue to be slaughtered at the hands of Israelis. After Giuliani's public rebuff, Al-Walid opened his purse in 2002 to killers instead, donating $500,000 to Hamas-linked CARE and a whopping $27 million to a Saudi telethon raising money for the Committee for the Support of the Al-Quds Intifada. But then, also in 2002, Al-Walid had an epiphany, as reported in Arab News, which he also owns. Arab countries can influence U.S. decision-making if they unite through economic interests, not political, Al-Walid stressed. We have to be logical and understand that the U.S. administration is subject to U.S. public opinion. We are not so active in this sphere, public opinion. And to bring the decision-maker on your side, you not only have to be active inside the U.S. Congress or the administration, but also inside U.S. society. The light dawneth for the Saudi billionaire. By 2005, Al-Walid had bought into Murdoch-owned News Corp and into Harvard and Georgetown both. It paid off, and fast. Also in 2005, with Muslims rioting in Paris in the worst street violence since 1968, Al-Waleed telephoned Rupert Murdoch, as Al-Waleed himself told an audience in Dubai, and said, "These are not Muslim riots. They are riots." The Fox News crawl about Muslim riots in Paris across the bottom of the screen changed to "Youth Riots in Paris." How could that not have been just the beginning? I could go on and on, but then I would be not digressing exactly, but beginning another book. The point is, how did this Fox henhouse situation come to be? From the point of view of homeland security, vapid authoritarian phrase, does it make any sense? No, but we don't make sense either. We rely on narrative, ideology to make a kind of sense for us. This entails severe restrictions, not only on what we say, but how we think. The first word to go after 9/11 was crusade, eliminating not only an appropriate metaphor and comparison, but also something of ourselves, as I wrote in The Death of the Grown-Up. Operation Infinite Justice, the name for the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, went next, because, as Islam told the Bush administration, only Allah dispenses infinite justice. That was just the beginning. The history of the decade that followed was a stuttering story of mongrel words and phrases, from Islamofascism to violent extremism, and morphing suffixes, ist and ism. It was a time of now-you-see-it-now-you-don't terminology. Jihad, jihadist, sharia, mujahideen, shaheed, taqiyya, jizya, caliphate. Apt phrases became verboten. Islamic terrorism, for example. Muslim violence. Islamic jihad. Concepts uniquely or almost uniquely Islamic were off-limits as soon as anyone noticed them. Supremacism, censorship, slavery, misogyny, polygamy, child rape, grooming, pederasty, absolutism, totalitarianism, honor killings. We may have intuited that apostasy did not go out with Galileo, and that beheadings did not end with the French Revolution, but Islam is a religion of peace. The real threat we decided to believe, or thought we had no choice but to believe, or just didn't think, is violent extremism. Limiting our brains to this empty phrase has done extreme violence to our thought processes. After a decade plus of game-on jihad that has transformed large swaths, including key urban centers of the West, into unrecognizable zones of Sharia compliance, it is violent extremism that has subsumed every other term and concept related to terrorism, which is another content-free term, in American public discourse. It has taken over our war planning, security protocols, political deliberations, and media reporting and analysis. Islam and its animating role in both the violence and the extremism have vanished. No wonder there is no discussion, debate, let alone understanding about the existential threat posed to the West and to liberty by Islamic immigration. Like a navy of Captain Hills's, helming a fleet of Arawas, we sail on, blind, deaf, and dumb. Hills only spent 4 years becoming brainwashed by paeans to Uncle Joe and communism. We have spent more than a decade listening to propaganda about Uncle Mo and the religion of peace. Just as Captain Hills had no context to understand the fears of his human cargo bound for Gulag slavery and death, we have no context to discuss Islam and its designs on liberty, conscience, on apostates, on women, on cartoonists in Scandinavia and France and Texas. At every level, we self-censor the knowledge essential to such an understanding. After all, if the problem is violent extremism, what's the problem? Have a nice flight. Here's the problem. Violent extremism is not terminology that informs or clarifies. It is what French scholar Alain Besançon has called the language of ideology and official vocabulary. When the individual accepts this official ideological lexicon from authority with a capital A, he explains, he is lost. The moment the individual accepts the language of ideology, he allows his mental world and his sense of self-respect to be hijacked along with the language. No matter how inadvertently he may have stumbled into the use of the official vocabulary, he is now part of the ideology and has, in a manner of speaking, entered into a pact with the devil. The importance of this pact cannot be overestimated. At a certain point, the language of ideology binds the mind to ideology, hijacking thoughts, individualism, and self-respect along the way. Communists have long utilized this demoralizing and confounding power that may be seized and projected through the careful control of language. Indeed, Besançon was writing about the trap of 20th century totalitarianism. The comparison to Islam, however, is apt. Islam is totalitarian, sharing numerous attributes with communism and Nazism both. For example, blueprints for world domination, control of private and public life, including speech, demotion of despised groups to inferior status, one party or all Islamic parties, political systems. Once upon a time, such comparisons between Islam and totalitarianism formed an area of learned study mined by all manner of Western academics and students of history. Noted scholars in the first half of the 20th century even used Islam's violent and fanatical example to explain the workings of Nazism and communism. There is another pertinent comparison to be made. Both despotisms induce identical conditions of paralysis in the West. The Netherlands' Geert Wilders made this point explicit, as in the following excerpt from a 2010 speech, listing some of the striking similarities among Islam, communism, and Nazism. Wilders then said, "There is one more striking parallel, but this is not a characteristic of the three political ideologies, but one of the West. It is the apparent inability of the West to see the danger. Our inability leads us to reject the logical and historical conclusions to be drawn from the facts, though we could and should know better. Here we go again. It's not the facts, old egg, bean, boy, and Bowser. It's those rotten conclusions." Wilders asks, as well he might, "What is wrong with modern Western man that we make the same mistake over and over again?" Nothing short of that pact with the devil invoked by Besançon begins to explain the problem. It was a soul-selling deal our forebears made with communism as represented by its Soviet regime. We, as their heirs, must come to terms with it. Otherwise, we will continue to pay, just as Solzhenitsyn said we would, until we do. And the lies will continue to redouble and compound, and the complicity too, and thus become our own, and then our children's. Wilders delivered this speech in Berlin one day before the 10th anniversary of the reunification of the two Germanies, divided from one another, of course, in that great victory of ours in World War II. It was a declaration against the Islamization of Germany, but it was also a declaration against all totalitarian creeds. Wilders invoked Soviet dissident Vladimir Bukovsky and his belief that the West never won the Cold War, never even fought it, because for most of the time, the West appeased communism and, as Bukovsky put it, appeasers don't win wars. Wilders then said, "Islam is the communism of today, but, because of our failure to come clean with communism, we are unable to deal with it, trapped as we are in the old communist habit of deceit and doublespeak that used to haunt the countries in the East and that now haunts all of us. Islam is the totalitarian threat of today. However, because we continue the deceit and doublespeak we adopted in response to communism, the totalitarian threat that presented itself yesterday, we are unable to deal with the new threat, the new communism of today. We deal with it in the same way we dealt with communism. Having been subverted and undermined, we apologize and converge." As Wilders asked, "What is wrong with modern Western man Did something happen to him? I think the answer is yes. Communism happened to him. Solomon aside, there was something new under the communist sun, under the shorter-lived Nazi sun, too. In his 1998 book, Century of Horrors, Communism, Nazism, and the Uniqueness of the Shoah, Alain Besançon explains what that was. Communism and Nazism set out to change something more fundamental than mores, that is, the very rule of morality, of our sense of good and evil. And in this, they committed acts unknown in prior human experience. And in this, our world was transformed. Besançon's focus on a discernible moral shift shines like a beam of light to reveal a switch in the continuum of human experience. It even offers something to hold on to, an anchor against answerless mental drift. In the search for a basis of understanding, maybe even a point from which to reclaim our moral bearings. On or about December 1910, human character changed, Virginia Woolf once wrote, a line that became quite famous, even if 1910 doesn't stand out to us as a monumental threshold, especially with World War I in the offing. In the end, she was off by a decade or so. Solzhenitsyn saw this same sea change that came with communism. He wrote, "Communism has never concealed the fact that it rejects all absolute concepts of morality. So too does Islam, which makes lying obligatory in cases where lying advances Islam." He continued, "It scoffs at any considerations of good and evil as indisputable categories. Communism considers morality to be relative, but I must say that in this respect, communism has been very successful." One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. He continued, "It has infected the whole world with the belief in the relativity of good and evil. Today, many people, apart from the communists, are carried away by this idea. Among progressive people, it is considered rather awkward to use seriously such words as good and evil. Communism has managed to persuade all of us that these concepts are old-fashioned and laughable." Where good and evil are old-fashioned and laughable, and bracketed by quotation marks, moral relativism takes hold, Lenin's universal legacy. The pervasiveness of such moral relativism is now familiar in the West to a point of cliché, an old hat feature of who are we to say non-judgmentalism. It has been imprinted on us again by the repeated, required use of certain words and phrases. It is deep-seated in the teachings of every school district in America, including divinity schools. It is contained in our public communication, our politicians' rhetoric of inclusiveness for all, even our personal conversations, which are often marked by the urgency to explain, to assure, to ward off suspicions of heresy, every ism and phobia that another person might suspect is in us, and judge us according to the ideological lights of racism or Islamophobia. No heresy is more embarrassing than to be exposed as a believer in objective, fixed, non-relative morality, which accounts for the reflexively self-deprecating displays that pass for old-think apologies. I don't mean to be rigid, but I'm not a prude, really. At the risk of sounding stuffy, old, old-fashioned, fuddy-duddy. Scrubbed from our Marx-influenced lexicon, gone from our minds, are the elevating concepts of decency, cleanliness, purity, and goodness. Solzhenitsyn wondered what would happen next. But if we are to be deprived of the concepts of good and evil, what will be left? Nothing but the manipulation of each other. The manipulation of each other through the manipulation of narratives. The fact is, can I say that? Facts no longer carry greater weight than authority's narrative. That's what happens without immutable morality, without good and evil. Objective fact, reasoning powers, logical deduction, and sound judgment must compete with lies, with propaganda, with agitprop, with deception, with coercion, with power. with violence. Whoever's narrative is louder, bigger, stronger, more dangerous, is going to prevail. Before communism left the realm of theory to become manifest in a state in 1917, good and evil commanded a consensus as roughly immutable as any code observed by human beings can be. That would change. With the start of the Great Depression in 1929, our confidence in free markets was shot. By the early 1930s, our deepest codes were under assault. Recognition in 1933 opened the floodgates. The U.S.-USSR relationship pitted a Judeo-Christian, primarily Anglo-Saxon notion of trust and bond against the ruthless expediency of a revolutionary and amoral regime. To initiate relations, the terror famine had to be ignored, the first big lie, as conquest saw it, and a great moral crime on our part. To maintain relations, we had to shun the facts. For example, if it was a condition of recognition that the Russians cease and desist clandestine measures to overthrow the USA, and it was such a condition, then continued recognition in the face of continued clandestine measures to overthrow the USA depended upon betrayals of logic and morality both. It was wrong. It didn't make sense. By rights, Soviet subversion inside the United States should have canceled or suspended the contract. Instead, in a world in which ideological means and ends were replacing rule of law, in a government increasingly penetrated by Soviet agents, it didn't make a bit of difference. We pretended it wasn't so. So began the slipperiest slope ever to complete subversion. The relationship between Soviet Russia and the West, then, was always predicated on lies. Soviet Russia told them, and then the West told them too. In 1982, when President Reagan called for that review of Soviet compliance over a quarter century of arms control treaties, it remains mind-boggling to note that this was the first such analysis, and that the Soviets were guilty of serious violations of virtually every major treaty and agreement. It didn't have to be that way. By July 1935, not even 2 years after the recognition he had championed, William C. Bullitt already foresaw the impossibility of normal relations with the by definition abnormal regime. He had realized the USSR was, no matter what its leaders said to the contrary, still determined to produce world revolution. His analysis of the Soviet state of mind is prescient. Diplomatic relations with friendly states are not regarded by the Soviet government as normal friendly relations, but armistice relations. And it is the conviction of the leaders of the Soviet Union that this armistice cannot possibly be ended by a definite peace, but only by a renewal of battle. Peace is looked upon merely as a happy respite in which future battles may be prepared. Bullitt, of course, was describing a communist phenomenon, but I haven't seen a better definition of Hudna, the Islamic term for armistice, outside the Islamic Encyclopedia, which again makes sense. Totalitarian Islam and communism are both revolutionary movements that drive forward to impose their dominion on all the earth. Unceasing struggle with all other cultures, as Conquest put it, in a phrase describing communist Russia, but equally suitable to Islamic Jihad. Any halt in that drive, any pause in the struggle, is only temporary. Such points of doctrine, however, fail to fit into the preferred narrative of authority. Communism, Islam, are both religions of peace. Contradictory evidence is to be ignored, shaded, or denied. Maybe George Orwell was late when in 1936 he observed the end of neutral fact, and Arthur Koestler concurred. Human character, our nation's character, had already changed or been changed. I'm going to flip the clock forward 30 years to 1969, when Yuri Besmenov, later known as Tomas Schumann, was contemplating defection to the West. Born in 1939, Besmenov was a highly trained linguist and KGB asset. who had never lived in a world with neutral fact or functioned without lies, big and small. As a KGB-trained journalist with Novosti, a joint creation of the Central Committee's Agitprop Department and the KGB, Besmanov was himself quite skilled at creating them, changing perception, as he might have put it. For some extraordinary reason, Besmanov, possessing that certain lucidity of heart and soul that Solzhenitsyn said existed in some souls in societies benumbed by lies, was able to see through it all, including through himself and everyone else around him. Later, he set down his remarkable thoughts at that moment. Observing the worldwide destruction of human minds caused by my motherland, unresisted and unpunished, and meditating about how easily all that mind-warping could be stopped, I wanted to believe that there in the West, some people and organizations we call reactionary circles know the situation and how to deal with our subversion. They had not done it, for some reason unknown to me at the time. But when needed, I thought, they would stop us for their own good. Hard to know whether to laugh or cry, defectors never seem to have imagined the extent to which Soviet efforts to subvert the West were already successful, he continued. Later, in India, I was surprised to realize that no one even thought we were doing anything wrong to their country. Are they blind and deaf, or is there something that makes them unaware of impending danger? I must affect and open their eyes, I thought. We will meet the Americans and we will tell them. But, as Besmanov would conclude, no one wanted either my information or to open up their eyes. Blind and deaf. Why? All these decades later, no one wants information about the Muslim Brotherhood's self-described civilization jihad either, or historical evidence of the toll and loss of dhimmitude under Islam. It hurts our heads. It exhausts the limits of our learned language of ideology. It falls outside the restrictions of our official vocabulary. I often wonder if it is the inhumanity of totalitarian ideologies that drives us away from full acknowledgement, as from the abyss, where we might perceive the extent of our own silent complicity and winnowing self-respect. Fresh evidence, then, corroborating facts, clarity of language, become doubly, triply worse than any of the depredations or even inhumanity of the offending creed. Such evidence exposes the moral compromise itself, and, as we've seen, nothing is worse than exposure. It becomes a matter of self-preservation, then, to sunder the links between facts and conclusion. Welcome to the world of PC, a state of continuing mental and moral crisis. It is just such a crisis that Orwell tried to make us understand in 1984, back when most readers probably thought what he was writing was still fantastical. All words grouping themselves round the concepts of liberty and equality, for instance, were contained in the single word, crime-think, while all words grouping themselves round the concepts of objectivity and rationalism were contained in the single word, old-think. Greater precision would have been dangerous. Greater precision would have been dangerous, so greater precision was verboten. Enough crime-think, enough old-think, enough Islam-is-peace-think, and we are ready to replace jihad with violent extremism, scrub Muslim youths from the Fox News crawl, and make the charge of Islamophobia a criminal offense. Welcome to the free world. With such truths repressed, falsehoods in every field were incessantly rubbed in print, at endless meetings, in school, in mass demonstrations, on the radio. The line is from Robert Conquest about Soviet Russia, but it sounds like something out of American PC. And what is PC? The tag itself, I have come to think, creates a linguistic cul-de-sac where we just park our brains. PC is, gosh, PC. We look no further. Sure, the acronym PC, political correctness, conveys the idea that something is phony, forced, and ideologically not logically inspired, but it doesn't advertise its bona fide totalitarian provenance. What Alain Besançon called the language of ideology, the official vocabulary, which, once accepted, once internalized, draws an individual into that ideological pact with the devil in which reasoning powers are lost. And it happened here. I can think of multiple points in my research where descriptions of totalitarian conditioning under Stalin sounded painfully, sickeningly familiar. Maybe the first flash lit up while I was reading a 1966 study by Paul Hollander about brainwashing techniques of Stalinist literature. The Soviets, he wrote, designed a literature to overhaul the popular system of values. So too did the diversity brigades, feminists, ethnicitists, sexualityists, racists, and more. The Soviets set out to inculcate regime-approved attitudes and behaviors by providing artistic representation of social reality in terms of what it ought to be like. Well, so did the commissars of the race, color, creed canon that replaced the Western canon in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. Typicality in socialist realism is, therefore, a device for presenting reality as it is supposed to be, Hollander continued. Again, describing the Soviet system, but conjuring thoughts of Western PC enforcement. As such, it is a means of evading or idealizing reality. How does Hollander's description of the Soviet system of overhauling popular values differ from our own system of inculcating diversity? The mechanisms behind the two kinds of regimes are completely different. Gulag versus professional ostracism, say, but the impact, the net effect, is perplexingly similar. Summing up the Kremlin's concerted efforts to provide models of behavior for the population in literature, Paul Hollander writes, "This objective can be viewed as a form of social control peculiar to totalitarianism." My first reaction on reading that last line was, "Oh yeah, it's pretty darn peculiar to the free world, too. For example, we have completely remade the English language with the political imposition of the feminist suffix person, thus changing the fundamental relationship between the sexes. We have completely transformed the image of the white man into the perennial dork whose main purpose in life is to serve as a foil to hip chicks or very wise women of color via television advertising, to take another example of social conditioning. All to reinforce a new victimology. Our cousins in Europe, meanwhile, have actually begun holding Inquisition-style speech trials from England to Holland to France to Austria and Denmark, thus instituting a totalitarianism enforced by the post-democratic state. So how free is our world that I can ask this question and many others besides and still sleep well at night? No knocks on the door, indicates very, very free. How free thinking, how free speaking is our world might be a better question. Powers that be have long ago learned that as a matter of social control, the Gulag was overkill. Marxist conditioning today is better enforced by PC codes that order our society by fiat, by peer group, and increasingly by law. Remember FDR's fond hopes for convergence? PC is one result, its origins in 20th century totalitarianism. We accept it, we participate in it, but we don't recognize it for what it is, not really. PC marks the incursion and entrenchment of ideology as social control in the West. Such ideology is not innate to Western republics. Indeed, the Cold War between the West and communism was not a struggle between two ideologies as it is commonly framed. The Western approach, as Robert Conquest writes, was not an ideological one at all. Western culture, he explained, had, in a general way, a view of politics which included political liberty and the rule of law. It did not, have a universal and exclusively defined mindset. Liberty is not a mindset. It defies mindset. That said, the struggle between the U.S. and the USSR was over ideology, all right. A struggle to resist the imposition of communist ideology in the West following the debacle of World War II. PC, then, is another label for big lies. Little lies, too. It describes the systematic suppression of fact, logic, and morality to advance and sustain the ideology of social control. The state, big and increasingly bigger brother, going back to the tragic pen of Owen O'Malley, who described the moral abyss into which the Allies disposed of the facts about the Katyn massacre in 1943, we see the essence of PC, the exchange of facts and judgment for ideological outcome. It was politically incorrect in 1943 to tell the facts about Katyn. It is politically incorrect in 2015 to tell the facts about Islam. Instead, then, as now, we accept, at this point we cling to, the official vocabulary, the language of ideology, in Besançon's pact with the devil. As a disembodied acronym, though, PC is its own little lie. The nickname fails to convey the grievous offense against objectivity committed in every instance. Even throwaway lines of PC speech, learning differences, chairperson, stack up in moral capitulation to censoring forces, ultimately staunching the flow of thought itself. In deference to ideology, evidence is denigrated. In submission to orthodoxy, logic is discarded. In the process, spontaneous thought, individual volition is lost. Liberty, too, is lost. All of it strangled in compliance to a party line. And then, on 9/11, came the second totalitarian wave. With our tragic past of deceit and double talk, no wonder we readily ceded the history, canon, and terminology of Islam for a new big lie: Islam is peace. The government tells us violent extremism is what endangers us. What reason do we have to doubt it? We have no reason, capacity to reason, that is, not anymore. We believe what authority tells us because we have surrendered the tools of thought. In his contribution to the famous 1949 collection of essays by ex-communists titled The God That Failed, Arthur Koestler repeatedly returns to the concerted use of set language to bind thought to ideology at the expense of evidence. He describes a conversation he had early in his communist career with Edgar, his party contact, in which they discussed the front page of a communist newspaper. "But every word on the front page is contradicted by the facts," I objected. Edgar gave me a tolerant smile. "You still have the mechanistic outlook," he said, and then proceeded to give me the dialectical interpretation of the facts. Gradually, I learned to distrust my mechanistic preoccupation with facts, and to regard the world around me in the light of dialectical interpretation. It was a satisfactory and indeed blissful state. Once you had assimilated the technique, you were no longer disturbed by the facts. Here, recounting his experience as a German communist in the 1930s, Koestler is nonetheless describing the post-communist, post-modern, post-9/11 American condition. It is the sinister overhaul of language and thought, so familiar that he personally engaged in, that was and is the primary tool of Marxist conversion and Islamic subversion. "Not only our thinking, but also our vocabulary was reconditioned," he explains. "Certain words were taboo. Certain other words became telltales by which to identify dissenters or enemies. Literary, artistic, and musical tastes," he writes, "were similarly reconditioned to support the renunciation of independent thought and logic necessary to submit to ideology." He writes, "We cast off our intellectual baggage like passengers on a ship seized by panic until it became reduced to the strictly necessary minimum of stock phrases, dialectical cliches, and Marxist quotations. To be able to see several aspects of a problem, and not only one, became a permanent cause of self-reproach. We craved to be single and simple-minded. We crave this too, or just go along with it, which is worse. And the U.S. government itself is happy to oblige. As a United States government publication urged, don't invoke Islam, don't harp on Muslim identity, avoid the term caliphate, never use the terms jihadist or mujahideen. Contemplating the murky origins of PC, Roger Kimball identified its place in the totalitarian continuum coming down to us from Rousseau and Robespierre, slippery sloping to Stalin and Mao. The goal, he writes, is to force a change of heart and mind through a coercive change of language. The PC strategy is that by refusing to speak the truth, we can change the truth. The truth doesn't change, of course, but our mental world and sense of self-respect does. In place of fact, we accept narrative. In place of passing judgment, we listen to authority. Thus, individual liberty shrinks. Such is the spawn of liberty's rendezvous with totalitarianism. In Roosevelt's hoped-for convergence, the rape of the West, we have become born liars, dupes, or both. Our roots, drawing from a tank of lies, dug far deeper into our past than I used to imagine, back in a time when I previously assumed that grown-ups, rational and moral actors, were still in charge. More surprising still, this tank of lies was dug in with the assistance of a crew of pirates we erroneously regard to this postmodern day as heroes, and, in FDR's egregious case, practically an American demigod. The more I learned, the more it became my intention, my mission, to break the whole thing open, or whatever parts of it I could reach. My research path, a self-tutorial down a completely unexpected rabbit hole, took me through a mass of complex but unraveling Gordian knots. Big lie after big lie after big lie. Pulling the strings, as bad as it made me feel sometimes, also felt like breaking a spell. Released from the black magic, I can't claim to have woken up to a new day of sweetness and light, especially since so many of history's princes turn out to have been poisonous toads. I keep my spirits up with a new pantheon of truth-tellers. Exposure brings into view so much that is bitter and shameful, all of it crying out for more and more revelation, reconsideration, and re-reckoning. Frankly, a truth commission, not unlike those envisioned for former dictatorships, would be a most worthy congressional undertaking. A select committee investigation is the most democratic mechanism by which daylight could and should enter our own closed archives and, it must be said, dark past. If my initial findings are correct, I think we would find more evidence of American betrayals, of both ourselves and of others, which would and should silence grating calls of American exceptionalism. The good war, please. The war to make the world safe for gulags seems to be more like it. The supposed moral clarity of World War II we yearn for isn't just a canard, but a psychedelic fantasy, testament to the staying power of one seductively potent placebo. The false narrative made vivid, lifelike, and indelible. All we have to fear is fear itself? No, it turns out there's much more to fear than that. The lies. The corrupting lies. Confess them all, then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And to think, I once regarded Roosevelt haters as an unfathomable anomaly. Now I see them as much maligned Americans who loved our republic more than the world, who did their duty to defend the Constitution against the encroachments of socialism, who cherished American lives over delusions of world peace, global government, or communist domination, whichever came first. So far, I haven't discovered these America Firsters who disbanded on December 7th, 1941, the day Harry Dexter White's Soviet plot came to fruition, to be the totalitarian sympathizers and anti-Semites they are relentlessly depicted as. Certainly not as compared to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the totalitarian sympathizer in the White House, who, after all, and really above all, when it comes to his enduring reputation as a great man in bronze by the Tidal Basin, failed to bomb train tracks leading to Auschwitz despite the fact that U.S. and British aircraft were operating in the skies near Auschwitz throughout much of 1944 and 1945. And therein lies maybe just one more tale, something I stumbled across in securing the detail about the Allied aircraft operating near enough to Nazi death camps to have blasted away at least the railroad that carried the cattle cars filled with oven-bound innocent men, women, and children. It seems that for more than 15 years, the Roosevelt Institute has been able to prevent the simple fact of FDR damning history from being re-entered into the permanent exhibit on the U.S. response to the Holocaust in the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., after first mysteriously seeing to it that it was censored in the first place. On first glance, this historical chiseling to protect FDR looks like subtle stuff. In 1993, the Holocaust Museum opened, and the text on a wall panel of a permanent exhibit on the U.S. Holocaust response noted that during the last years of the war, American Jewish organizations made repeated requests to the War Department to bomb Auschwitz that were denied. In May 1996, the text was revised to report dissension in the Jewish ranks. The panel now stated that a few Jewish leaders asked for the bombing, while others opposed it. It continued, "Like some Allied officials, both sides feared the death toll or the German propaganda that might exploit any bombing of the camp's prisoners." Not the most felicitously written sentence in the world, but the gist was clear. Suddenly, the Roosevelt White House had permission to do nothing. Even the Jews were divided. Roosevelt was innocent of the worst sin of omission. So what if the historical record reveals practically no dissent whatsoever actually existed? What happened here? Hard to say, but according to the posthumously published diaries of New Deal historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr., William J. Vandenhuyvel, founder of the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute and father of Katrina Vandenhuyvel, owner and editor of The Nation, which somehow seems relevant, carried out a campaign in the 1990s to persuade the Holocaust Museum to make the Roosevelt sanitizing change. Even now, even after the museum was persuaded to conduct further research confirming Roosevelt's unconscionable inaction, Roosevelt to date still clings to his Holocaust halo. Keepers of the flame do not want Roosevelt remembered as the man who could have stopped the Holocaust in its train tracks, but didn't, and thus they continue to devote themselves to damage control. After all, one chink in the armor might lead to another, and before you know it, there might be a bona fide re-examination of the industrial dictator, who, even before the events I have tried to reconstruct in this book took place, ushered in the New Deal and all the socialism in America that followed in a nearly uninterrupted pink tide of presidents from number 32 to number 44. Then again, nearly 70 years away from the Holocaust, is there still any damage left to control? No, there is damage to reveal. "We lost World War II," wrote Martin Dies. Yes. "We lost the Cold War," wrote Vladimir Bukovsky. Yes. "We even made everything worse in the process," writes my final iconoclast, British soldier and historian, General J.C.F. Fuller. Oh, great. In 1949, Fuller wrote, "Though Germany was defeated and National Socialism overthrown, Russia and Stalinism took their place. Great Britain was bankrupted, and her empire is now in a state of dissolution, and yearly America is spending billions of dollars to stem the communist flood." And, he might have added, turning Europe socialist in the process through Marshall Plan aid. Because the Americans who ran it applied to European recovery methods of social planning which are anathema to most businessmen, enthused British socialist R.H.S. Crossman in 1950. Fuller's catalyst, too, was the USA, and not for the first time. It started, he argues, in 1917. Had you not stepped in, we should have been forced to come to terms between ourselves, as we have done scores of times before. Without your aid, and it was generous, we Europeans would have concluded the First World War, probably in 1917, by a negotiated peace, which could not have been worse than the one established. Fascinating theory, no? No U.S. in France, and maybe no Lenin in Moscow either. That might have meant no Red Russia, possibly, no Stalin, perhaps, no triumph of relativism over morality, maybe. Of course, then again, maybe not. Still, if the Yanks weren't coming, George M. Cohan would not only have missed out on writing one great song, but the lost generation would not have strayed. Maybe no go-go 1920s. Maybe no speculation. Maybe no bubble. Maybe no crash. Maybe no FDR. And what of our next rendezvous with destiny? That was no good either, according to Fuller. Again, in the last war, what with your lend-lease, etc., you got entangled in the European brawl, and between 1942 and 1945, backed by your enormous industrial power, you laid the greater part of Europe flat. Of course, he didn't know the half of it, namely, that we laid Europe flat, basically, in Stalin's service. Fuller continued, again, there would have been a negotiated peace, which could not have been as bad as the present so-called one, though it is true that it would almost certainly have been followed, if not preceded, by a war between Germany and Russia. Nothing could have been more beneficial to the world at large, for in it the two dictatorial powers which were threatening the Western way of life would have bled each other white. That's what politicians, from Herbert Hoover to Harry Truman, said before, but other voices prevailed to convince us to beef up one totalitarian power and starve out the other, fulfilling most, if not all, of Stalin's fondest wishes. I can feel pushback from decades of good war conditioning. But, how could Uncle Sam not have done everything possible to stop Hitler in Europe and save the Jews? Well, you know what, America? Uncle Sam didn't do everything possible to stop Hitler in Europe. Otherwise, it sure seems to me that the war might have ended no later than 1943. Having abandoned his own army in the Philippines to siege, death, and Japanese bestiality, Uncle Sam laid Europe flat, helped build an evil empire, and didn't save the Jews. Not the last million, not the last hundred. And these blasted bits of history leave us where? Someplace, I'm afraid, with poor, ravening man in Yeats's Meru. Civilization is hooped together, brought under a rule, under the semblance of peace, by manifold illusion. But man's life is thought, and he, despite his terror, cannot cease ravening through century after century, ravening, raging, and uprooting, that he may come into the desolation of reality. Having done a little ravening and uprooting of my own, I have to say I've come a long way from my freshman fall at Yale, when I met a sunny-faced boy from Ohio who happened to tell me, I can't recall why, that his parents, both of them white-haired physicians, by the way, hated Franklin Roosevelt. In a way, maybe that's where this book began. In Freddie's household, Roosevelt's name was Mudd, Los Angeles-born and Hollywood-bred. I couldn't have been more puzzled. How could this be? My dad's first vote as a GI in Northern Europe somewhere between D-Day and the Bulge was for Roosevelt. My mom's family was Roosevelt all the way. I didn't get it, couldn't get it. Freddie came from Ohio, home, I later learned, of Mr. Republican, Senator Robert Taft, the son of President Taft, who entered national politics to try to guard the Constitution against the New Deal. I lived in Yale's Taft entryway one year. Maybe not a harmonic convergence, but I like the connection. Freddie also liked vanilla milkshakes. I put that and his family's politics down to the exotica of the heartland. Even a quarter century later, when, at a used bookstore in Vermont, I somewhat fatefully picked up a 1979 book titled Roosevelt, Churchill, and the World War II Opposition, a revisionist autobiography by George T. Eggleston, I could still detect the residual radioactivity that wafted off the cover. Was I holding in my hands a book by a fascist? A Nazi? Or, maybe worse in the American context, an isolationist? Isolationist, yes, and, as an explanation of the point of view, intriguingly so. In fact, I recommend the book to anyone interested in continuing this re-examination of our 20th century history. The process is vital not only to understanding our past, but to mounting any successful rediscovery and restoration of Americanism, allegiance to the principles contained in the Declaration and the Constitution. Something is not right in this democratic republic, and it's getting worse. Then again, is this a democratic republic? That too becomes a trick question after peering past history's mirrors. In 1955, the eminent journalist and author John T. Flynn, one of the most famous and prolific critics of statism, collectivism, and Roosevelt, not necessarily in that order, argued in his book, The Decline of the American Republic, that following the depression-triggered, war-entrenched Roosevelt-Truman revolution in government spending, taxation, regimentation, and centralization, known as the New Deal and, later, less memorably, as the Fair Deal, the essential character of American society had changed beyond recognition. The USA, Flynn wrote, in that formative year of McDonald's, Rock Around the Clock, and Disneyland, bore only an external and superficial resemblance to the republic that had existed for 144 years until 1933. And who even knew the difference by 1955 when Americans, 40 years of age, born in 1915, had no adult memory of anything different? The Constitution, he noted, remained officially unchanged. It had been done by sheer usurpation of power by the federal government. As if to agree, Norman Thomas, perennial socialist candidate for president, was moved to write in 1953. Here in America, more measures once praised or denounced as socialist have been adopted than once I should have thought possible short of a socialist victory at the polls. Am I saying everyone who voted for X, Y, and Z were or are socialists? No, because I doubt that was the case. These legislators, however, almost without pause, voted for law after law that increased our reliance on and our subservience to the burgeoning state. Whether Marxist, communist, socialist, or fascist-inspired, and there are strong parallels among all these totalitarian systems, as Jonah Goldberg has compellingly argued in Liberal Fascism, our history since Roosevelt has been one of an expanding central government. Even under Ronald Reagan, the federal government grew 3%. A state that took on the guise of paternalism in the early 1930s has become increasingly authoritarian, thuggish even, and the citizens who sought and accepted that helping hand have become both ward-like and less free. As far back as 1934, the New York Times ran a headline, New Deal Paternalism Imperils All Individualism. It described a speech by Massachusetts Governor Joseph Ely to a conference of America's governors. There is no stopping short of the end of the road, Ely said, and at the end of the road we shall have a socialistic state, invoking Stalin in Russia, Mussolini in Italy, and Hitler in Germany, all newly minted dictators at this time. Ely pointed out that where these despots ruled, individualism had passed from the people to dictators making the people into children of government. Echoes of de Tocqueville. One century earlier, the French visionary described the infantilizing effect of a paternalistic despotism in America, imagining the immense protective power of a state with absolute power and likening such power to parental authority which keeps citizens in perpetual childhood. He wondered, why should it not entirely relieve them from the trouble of thinking and all the cares of living? It would seem that the mortal blow against the grown-up, the free citizen, was struck, softly, once liberty was no longer paramount in this country, once ideology began to take precedent over facts, once we traded in the American ideal of rugged individualism for the material markers of the American dream. If once upon a time Americans subscribed to our founders' belief that our Creator endowed us with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, there came a time when we expected a package of perks, car, house, PlayStation, to sweeten the deal. Suddenly, those perks became darn near an entitlement, an attitude entirely befitting the subjects in Tocqueville's absolute state. In fact, measured in material goods as it is, the contemporary American dream is a vision driven by the Marxist belief in the primacy of the economic. From recognition to convergence. No wonder Norman Thomas was tickled by the direction of the country in 1953. Of course, by 1958, he was beside himself. The United States is making greater strides toward socialism under Eisenhower than even under Roosevelt, he enthused, and particularly in the fields of federal spending and welfare legislation. By 1962, the man who had run for president on the socialist ticket 6 times had concluded that the difference between Democrats and Republicans is Democrats have accepted the ideas of socialism cheerfully, while Republicans have accepted them reluctantly, just not by name. As Upton Sinclair put it in a 1951 letter to Norman Thomas, the American people will take socialism, but they won't take the label. We take euphemism instead, official vocabulary, language of ideology, the PC pact with the devil, the big lie as big con, the narrative of authority. How did it all happen? I think I now know a little bit of the answer. If once it was vitally important to shore up America's bastions, something else is called for now. What's needed is a full-scale assault on those bastions of unreality, those safe houses of secrets, all in a painful but restorative effort to upend the narratives of authority, to break those conspiracies of silence which have endured through too many lifetimes. Put another way, it's time to avenge the victims and the truth-tellers, the voiceless and the voices of one. It's time to avenge the American betrayal of liberty herself.